Welcome, everybody. Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Vowdrin. With me, my co-host from Bixby, Oklahoma, the legendary cowboy Barry Rose. Barry, how you doing today?
I'm riding the horse and I'm feeling great.
Well, that's something that only the ladies know about you, Barry. So today on this show, we're not just going to break kayfabe on wrestling. We will break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, pop culture, everything. Fucking everything under the sun, we're going to break kayfabe on, Barry. We're going to ask the listeners to chew on the proverbial, as Kevin Sullivan would say, the cosmic cookie, Barry, and let breaking kayfabe enter into your realm, into your senses, and let us break kayfabe on life, my friends. Do I sound like a good minister there, Barry?
You did. I was going to go either testify or amen. I didn't know which one to do, so I didn't say either. But yeah, maybe sound like a minister, a deacon,
the Reverend,
if you
will. The Reverend Booker, the good Reverend Booker. So today on episode 54, Barry, episode 54. When this thing comes out, I'll be counting down and a little more than a week away from the daughter's wedding, and I am freaking the fuck out. But anyway, on today's show, we're going to take a look at two matches that were recommended to us. And for the first time, and Barry, I have to say a long time, we're going to go someplace we don't really go a lot here on Breaking Kayfabe. We are going to Mexico. We are going to September 19th, 2014. Barry, we're doing a match from this fucking decade. How often does that happen? Atlantis versus Ultimo Guerrero. And also, we are going to watch friend of the show, Jerry Briscoe, versus the legendary Danny Hodge in a match from, I believe, October of 1973. So all that plus more, folks, because not only that, but we will have part two of our favorite pre-1970 films. Barry and I have gone back and done intensive research on all these movies that maybe we skipped. One that I said I had to fall on the sword because I can't believe I fucking forgot to mention it when I was talking about great courtroom dramas, Barry. So we're going to talk about that. And a whole lot more. Barry, are you ready to go, my friend?
I am in the saddle. I am slapping the horse's butt, and I'm ready to ride this out.
And the horse is going, thank you, sir. May I have another? Before we get going, I want to acknowledge, Barry, the day that we are recording this, I happen to note on Twitter that today is the birthday, or would have been the birthday, of the American dream, Dusty Rhodes, a man that certainly impacted the state of Florida and CWF, Barry.
Yeah, and you know, impacted professional wrestling, and certainly, you know, if you talk about the biggest baby faces of the 1970s, Dusty Rhodes is certainly right there. He's top five. I would say he's probably top three. Some would say he was number one as well. So, you know, Dusty was, his impact, especially in the 70s, his impact is immeasurable. And if, you know, there was a lot of criticism of Dusty in the 80s, and a lot of it was valid, you know, not to say that it wasn't valid, but at the same time, he was in a different position, I think, in the 70s, and he was able to connect with an audience that few really were at that level in the 1970s. So, yeah, you know, losing Dusty Rhodes, as we did, you know, 3.5 years ago, was just absolutely huge. And we do these fan fests down in Tampa. And, you know, even when you look at the losses that we've had over the last 3 years, or, you know, go back maybe even a couple of years before, maybe the last 5 years, it's just been really, really tough. And, you know, I was talking with, you know, someone that has come to all the fan fests, and they were like, so if you could, you know, draw up a dream list of guys to come to the fan fest, who would it be? And this would be a dream list of people, you know, deceased or alive. It didn't matter. And obviously Dusty was right at the very top of that too. So losing Dusty was a big thing. And I think there's this negative connotation that people have of Dusty. And I think a lot of it had to do when he was in power, with Crockett and Turner, in TBS and things like that. But, you know, Dusty as a wrestler, you know, come on. He was the man in the 70s.
Yeah, and, you know, quite fairly, you know, for all his flaws that he had near the end of his run as a booker in Crockett and WCW and towards the late 80s, you know, one has to point out that 85, 86 into early 87, Dusty had that territory on fire. I mean, like, how can you not look back fondly on that, you know, the whole Midnight Express, Rock and Roll, Magnum TA, Nikita, Tully Blanchard, The Horseman. I mean, that's just, that's so such a part of so many people's memories growing up that listen to this show, that are on our Facebook group. And, you know, it had a bad ending, but when it was going good, it was going real damn good, Barry.
It was too, but you know, that human nature always says that, you know, you're going to remember how things ended. So, yeah. You know, for Dusty, a lot of it is his legacy was tainted. But I do think in hindsight, you know, with him being gone for 3 years now, that's definitely softened a little bit. And you're 100% right. You know, for every positive, you know, there might have been a negative, but at the same time, some of those positives were absolutely huge. He did some amazing stuff. We saw the real rise and emergence of Magnum TA, and then, you know, having Nikita Koloff, that really was a stroke of genius when you look at it. Having Nikita Koloff turn, you know, literally overnight into a babyface was a risky move as well. You know, I remember being shocked when I saw it, but boy, did that ever pay off.
Yeah, and you know the amazing thing is, you're absolutely right. The turn itself was absolutely done brilliantly, and it received such a huge pop for the crowd. That being said, I don't know if post-turn it ended up being, what's the word I'm looking for? It was not the sum of its parts. You know what I mean? It should have been much bigger than it was. But the turn itself was such a, you know, such a holy shit moment in TV. But want to give a special – I'm sorry, go ahead.
And in the short term, it was actually really successful. I think long term is where it didn't pay off. But short term, it was good.
Yeah, and I wonder if in retrospect, I think it would have been interesting to do a short-term turn and then a turn back.
Yeah, I would agree.
Dusty could have, yeah, because I just don't think that Nikita at that point, he wasn't really made to be a babyface. You know, and I say that, and I remember, you know, that they based it on the fact that how much merch for Nikita they were selling with the T-shirts and all that kind of stuff. Okay, Barry, I want to give a special shout-out to our man Brian Last, the producer, and Mike Mills over at the Mid-South Wrestling Podcast, Barry. I've had a chance to listen to about, I want to say 3, 4, maybe 5 episodes. And boy, this is really good stuff as they go back and they listen to, they watch old Mid-South episodes going back. I think they started in like December of 1981. And it is really good stuff. They have lots of audio clips of Bill Watts, Boyd Pierce, all the, you know, the JYDs, Skandar Akbar. And it's just, and they sit there and analyze everything, and they analyze the guys that are boring and they don't understand why they're even on television. But it's really fun to listen to Cowboy Bill Watts explain an angle, because I don't think anyone was as good as Bill Watts at explaining an angle. And it's a listen that I think anyone that enjoys this show, I recommend you check it out. Mike Mills and Brian Last on the Mid-South Wrestling Podcast. Now, Barry, I want to ask you before we move along here, did you get a chance, if you didn't watch the whole show, and I'm kind of throwing this at Barry unexpectedly, I didn't give him a tip off on this. If you didn't see the whole show, did you happen to see the finish of the UFC pay-per-view last weekend between Conor McGregor and, I'll just call him Khabib because I can't pronounce his last name.
Come on. I know that there are hundreds of thousands of listeners right now with their fingers crossed praying that you're going to try to pronounce the man's last name.
No such fucking luck, my friend.
Damn. Well, we all lose. I guess we can just wrap up the show right now if you're not going to do that, Jeff. But so I woke up Sunday morning and I got a text from you. And unfortunately, but it would take me 5 minutes to go scroll through and find it. But it was like, holy shit, I wish we were recording. Did you happen to see the finish of the UFC fight? So I did not. So I got on the computer and I got on Google immediately and I watched the finish. And I think I texted you back and I said, holy shit. And certainly at this point, by the time this airs, it would have been over a week and a half. So, but that really absolutely was a massive clusterfuck on a couple of different levels, but unbelievable. So I had a couple of takeaways and I think I said this to you, and it was interesting to see because there was a lot of varied opinions on social media. Jerry Briscoe, that you mentioned earlier, said, nice way, you know, stay classy. I forget exactly what it was, but it's like, you know, you've made all this progress, UFC, and now you're like right back in the bars fighting again. And he was very, very, very critical. What I saw from it was really two things. One was, I think the myth of Conor McGregor was finally revealed. He was exposed. He's been basically, and he's a very bright guy because he marketed himself as this lunatic with this gigantic mouth, but he's not the greatest fighter in the world by far. Secondly, I think UFC for the, you know, you go back maybe 10 years ago when it was the talk of the town, and UFC has been a little stagnant. I don't, you know, Conor certainly brought some life back into it, but my wife, you know, 5 minutes after you said it, Jeff, my wife goes, did you see what happened in UFC last night? My wife, who does not watch UFC. So it was hitting the mainstream media, and that's what everyone was talking about, which is the greatest publicity that company could have ever received.
Yeah, and for everything negative that was said and that this is garbage, and, you know, I have to tell you, I would love to, you know, I've seen videos out there where they take the audio from Jim Ross at the pay-per-view on, what was it, 98-99, where Mankind goes through the cage.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for them to do some kind of thing with Jim Ross and Bill Watts where it's breaking down and he doesn't have his union card, but he's moving some furniture when that guy jumps over the octagon and goes out in the crowd and starts wailing on the guy. I mean, it was just – freaking breaking down in Vegas that night. It was fucking crazy time. And
what
you know
that guy's name, Jeff? The guy that jumped over the cage?
His name was Khabib. That's what we'll Khabib. Call it.
We're going to stay with that. Okay.
Yeah. Hey, good luck with that. And you know, and you sit there and you watch it, and at first you're going, "This is a fucking disgrace, man." And all I'm thinking about is if there's anybody at ringside that's not involved in this, that just is there as a spectator. Hello, lawsuit, and you know someone's going to be forking out some cash. But upon reflection, you also have to consider, you know, for everything you said about Conor McGregor, which I agree. You know, the guy is not stupid, and he is. An incredible marketer of himself, you know, and
one of the best of all time, I think we can say.
Yeah. And I mean, and let me just paraphrase this. I would compare him to Ali, not as a fighter, but as a self promoter. I certainly don't think he's in the class of Ali as a fighter, but you know, the way this guy has people talking after a match where he got tapped out, and to think about it, how many people are now sitting there going, boy, you know, I'd love to see those guys get in the ring against each other again, you know? And I was listening to Jimmy Cornette's podcast, and he said, you know, this is the best time to have a tag team UFC, the first tag team, you know, like Khabib and his corner man against Conor McGregor and somebody of his own choice. I mean, that you talk about selling some fucking tickets, Barry. I would drop some cash to watch that pay-per-view. And he pointed out, Jimmy did, how this has obviously such a pro wrestling vibe to it, yep. And you know, an appearance to it. And he's absolutely correct. I can't argue with him because it really did have that. And you sit there and you think to yourself, how much is this? You know, and I saw that Meltzer had pointed out on Twitter that this was absolutely not a work, but you know, it sure had that smell about it, you know? And did I think it was anything? But no, I don't. But I can't help but think that that Dana White, who's a great promoter of his product, isn't sitting there thinking, okay, we slap him on the wrist, much like we did when McGregor threw the damn whatever it was at the bus, and then we got Money in the Bank waiting about a year from now. You know, I just can't help but believe that isn't going to happen.
Yeah, so definitely a couple of thoughts with that, too. So Dana White, he's so controlled with his responses to these events. You know, when McGregor threw the metal cage into the bus, he was so controlled. And I don't want to say, you know, I guess he watches every single word that he says, but at the same time, it's a black eye in some ways, but it also, everybody was talking about that incident. So this is the greatest publicity. It's the greatest thing you could do because, again, UFC had been stagnant. We're talking about McGregor, too. So McGregor lost this fight. There certainly is going to be a rematch. This will be, in my opinion, one of the highest grossing rematches in UFC history. It would have to be. But didn't McGregor get something like $55.5 million for losing this fight?
Yeah, and, you know, that's the thing. Guess what people aren't talking about now? That he lost. They're talking about what happened after the fight and how they can't wait for these guys to fight again. And that's what's so absolutely, it smells like an angle. And if it is, holy shit, whoever cooked it up is a genius. And oh man, I can't say enough good things. Barry, you know what time it is right now, Barry?
Oh, yes. Looking at my clock, and it's actually got the state of Florida and a big sun over it. And we should say, too, you know, the state of Florida in many different ways has taken a major hit over the last 48 hours that we've been recording this this podcast with the hurricane. And then just seeing the photos today and the devastation that occurred, you know, are definitely our thoughts and prayers, which I get our thoughts and prayers don't really amount to a lot of shit. But our thoughts and prayers definitely go to everybody down in that region. And I saw the photos today of Mexico Beach, and it reminded me, the first thing that I saw, and Jeff, you can relate to this, was Hurricane Andrew. It was just houses that were just leveled. It just like tornadoes had come through and just leveled all these houses. And it's just, you know, you and I, we lived through Hurricane Andrew, and it was something I've talked about, you know, previously, but you know, when you live through a major hurricane like that, it doesn't go away in 48 hours. You live with that for 6 months to a year, as we did with Hurricane Andrew. And unfortunately, I think these people down in the panhandle, are going to be dealing with this for a year or years to come, because this devastation is absolutely huge.
Yeah. And, you know, we don't want to also forget, the folks in North Carolina on the ocean side there in like Wilmington and towns like that. And you know, the sad thing, Barry, is I was watching it on the Weather Channel, and they showed the hurricane as it made its way through southern part of Georgia, was heading up to North Carolina, and they thought it was going to go through Wilmington. I was like, holy shit, these poor people in Wilmington are going to get a gut punch twice. But yeah, as far as where this thing hit, it was heading, first of all, how weird was it? It was like a tropical depression, and then all of a sudden, it's like a category 2, it's going to hit the panhandle. I was like, where the hell did that come from? And my brother lives in Destin with his wife, and they happen to be in Italy on vacation. And I texted him, and it amazes me that I text my brother and he's in Italy, and he texts me back in 2 minutes. Oh yeah, yeah, we're on a train. And I said, well, is everything okay with your house? Yeah, we got someone there. And I'm like, you know, he's a contractor, so I guess if it is any kind of damage, he can take care of it. But you know, and luckily I found out some other family members that live in that area happen to be out of town. So, but oh yeah, just a gut punch for those people in the panhandle. And we definitely, I share Barry's thoughts, that our thoughts and prayers are with you. And now, just a little levity into a otherwise serious situation. It's time for Florida Man or Not, Barry. Are you ready, my friend?
I'm ready. And I'm, again, I have a lot of concern for my side, because my track record over the last time I did this was not good. So I got to say, I have spent the last few days studying up on weird stories all across the globe, especially concentrating on the state of Florida. So hopefully I can redeem myself this week.
Well, I'd like to think I threw you a couple softballs this week, Barry, just to, you know.
I appreciate that.
Make you feel better about yourself. Okay, first story, Barry. The heist went exactly as planned. Overnight thieves drove a stolen van right through the front doors of a marijuana shop, grabbed as much pot as they could carry, abandoned the van, and fled in a getaway vehicle. The only hitch? All the marijuana they grabbed was actually oregano. The still-at-large thieves, believed to be teenagers, grabbed all the stuff in the display cases, and those cases don't contain the real thing. Had the thieves made it to the locked bud room, the story might be different. Barry, Florida or not Florida? I'm giving you an easy one here.
Yeah, well, it certainly sounds like these thieves could have been from the state of Florida. I'm going to say this did not occur in Florida, though.
The quality state of Colorado.
I was hoping that it was one of those states, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It was Colorado. So, but the thieves were actually from the state of Florida.
Well,
so
of
I
course.
See that. Probably.
That makes it better, yes. So, okay, next story, Barry. Bad habits. Police say a man answering to a stolen car charge drove to court in a stolen car. Authorities say 25-year-old Jonathan Rivera was at court on Wednesday to appear before a judge on a charge of first-degree larceny and tampering with a motor vehicle. From back in February, parking authority agents scanning license plates outside the courthouse found a car that had been reported stolen. Police kept an eye on the car, and they arrested Rivera when he got inside and tried to drive away. Barry, Florida or not Florida?
This was definitely Florida. This happened in the state of Florida for sure.
Barry, this definitely did not happen in the state of Florida. This happened in Connecticut. So that was an extremely
Connecticut.
You know.
The bane of my existence, Connecticut. Yeah. All right, great.
So, okay, Barry, next one. Authorities say a man who was in court for violating his bond on a drug charge is in even more trouble after a wad of cocaine fell out of his hat while he was in front of the judge. I hate when that happens, Barry. It's just awful.
Has that ever happened to you when you've been in court?
That never happened. We had a guy once show
up. I don't mean to you personally, Jeff. I mean, have you ever witnessed this is what I meant.
Of course, that's what you meant. Yes.
Okay.
But I was in court. The closest I can say to this, and this is a story that always made me laugh. I want to say this is about 15 years ago. I'm in court. And we have what's called arraignment court, where someone will come in and they enter a plea of not guilty, no contest, whatever. The first appearance in front of a judge to answer to the charges. So a young kid, 19, 20 years old, comes up and he's charged with possession of the old cannabis and he's wearing a weed shirt. OK. And I kind of started snickering and the judge like, is what? And I like pointed to my shirt and then the kid. And she said, did you really think it was a good idea to wear that shirt to court today, especially since you're charged with possession of cannabis? And the kid, I'll never forget, it looks right at her and says, oh, this shirt is certainly not meant as any sort of endorsement of marijuana.
Ah, yeah. Oh, wow.
That took a set of brass balls. So anyway, reports are that 43-year-old Juan Jose Vidrio was standing next to two other defendants at district court podium when he took his hat off and a square of the old folded paper fell out, Barry. Police officer watched the paper filled with cocaine fall to the floor. Barry, Florida or not Florida?
This one is absolutely the beautiful state of Florida. It's got to be.
Wrong. This is the beautiful state of Colorado.
Again? So are you on the Colorado Weird Story website now, like I would be? All right.
Okay, Barry. So here's one that I feel like is a bit of a softball for you, Barry.
I hope so. I really, because that's what I need right now, Jeff, okay, to build up my confidence. I need to
softball. A Frenchman who was arrested when he arrived in the U.S. for a world beard growing championship, who knew there was such a thing, was sentenced to 20 years in prison for being the online trafficker known as the Oxy Monster. The sentence was imposed by U.S. District Court Robert Scalia on Gal Valieris. He pled guilty to drug conspiracy and money laundering. He had a warrant out for him, Barry, and he came back for a beard and mustache contest. Barry, Florida or not Florida?
So my first instinct is to say not Florida, but then if I say not Florida, it will be Florida. Because the previous story, so I'm just trying to get some sort of logic in this rhythm going. This definitely happened in the state of Florida.
Well, actually, Barry, I'm going to tell you what happened. I'm going to give you a hall pass on this one.
All right.
Because he was arrested, I believe, in Atlanta, but then he was extradited and sentenced in Florida. So I'll throw you a bone there and give you a half a
point.
All right,
I can take that. Okay.
So let's see. Last story. What I get for not being emotionally prepared here, Barry.
Any like chlamydia on a pole or anything like that? I really enjoyed those stories.
That is still, you know, the ultimate story so far, Barry. Let's see.
It's still my favorite. It's that. So 2 weeks ago, I believe it was 2 weeks ago, but it was that and the guy making cookies on the George Foreman grill that started a fire. I really enjoyed those too.
Yeah. Okay. Back in April, high school senior didn't want to turn in her cheerleading uniform when she graduated, so she told the cops someone broke into her house and stole them. The only thing stolen in the apparent break-in, Barry, were the uniforms. That's the only thing the thieves stole. That was her story to the police. Barry, Florida or not Florida?
That was not Florida. That was Texas.
Barry, I will give you a round of applause. Not only was your answer correct, it was in Texas. So
seriously?
You're a little... You little son of a bitch, you probably read that story.
I did it. You know what? Because whenever I hear cheerleading stories, I always think of Texas.
That's true. That's a very good point.
Yeah.
That's a very good point. Okay, now it is time, Barry, for us to discuss a couple of matches that we're taking a look at. We are going to go to September 19th, 2014, Mexico City, Arena Mexico, where Barry Rose has been, by the way.
Yeah.
We are talking Atlantis versus Ultimo Guerrero, Mask versus Mask. Barry, what did you think of this one?
So this was a good match. Let's not you know, this was not a great match. I think there was a lot of drama built around this match, which, you know, certainly when you're looking at two guys that had been opponents, then they were tag partners, and then certainly had a really heated feud. So it's a very good match. You know, in my opinion, too, there are a lot of matches in Mexico that I think are good, but very few attain and hit that level of being, let's say, 4 stars or just the great, as I like to say, it's the greatest match I've ever seen. You don't often see that in Mexico. However, the passion of the crowd, in my opinion, elevates a lot of these matches, because I can tell you, being there, you know, when I was in Mexico, was it February of this year? And I was at Arena Mexico, and I think I saw 7 matches, and one was very good, and the rest were literally forgettable. However, the crowd is so passionate, it almost doesn't matter what's taking place in the ring, because they pop for every movement. They're vociferous. They're always on their feet. They're chanting. They're fans. I mean, that's what I like about it. They're true fans. They get into every single thing that happens, and then the wrestlers respond to that. So, this was a good match, too. And Atlantis is a guy, I used to watch Lucha Libre regularly 30 years ago, and Atlantis has been around for something like 35 years. He was 52 years old when this match took place. So, I give him a lot of credit, because he, you know, I'm 54, and this guy moved like I did when I was like 26. So, you know, a lot of credit. And Ultimo Guerrero is not a kid either. So, solid match. It's a mass versus mass match. Máscara versus Máscara match. Guerrero wins the first fall by pin. Atlantis comes back. He wins the second fall by submission. And both these falls take place literally in like the first 7 minutes of this match. But it's really the drama of that third fall, which is great. That's good booking right there. You know, get the first two falls out of the way, one apiece, and then let's spend the next 20 minutes having the third fall with near falls and submissions, etc., to see who's going to lose the mask. Eventually, Atlantis does win. He does a backbreaker submission, and he wins. And there's a lot of drama. And Guerrero takes off the mask, and he hands it. And he looks like he's crying, you know, and it doesn't look like one of these, like, Ric Flair type of crying deals that, you know, hey, Rick, it's windy outside, and then Rick breaks into tears. This looked legitimate, you know. He had tears in his eyes, and he hands the mask over to Atlantis. So there's so much drama around it, you know. And to me, Atlantis was a guy too. He was the ultimate babyface when I used to watch Lucha Libre, and when I lived in South Florida, I would watch it. It was on every Sunday night on Galavision, and I loved watching it. It was 2 hours. I would record it, and I would keep the best matches. And he was one of those guys. He was considered the ultimate babyface, and even when he turned heel, little kids still loved him. You know, he was still this figure that little kids were actually being drawn to. So I guess in hindsight, it's a good match. If you're not into Lucha, I don't know if this is going to be the match that's going to get you into Lucha. There are some matches, I think, from the 80s or maybe even early 90s that I think would blow you away. And one of the matches, there was a match with Hurricane Ramirez Jr., and I remember watching this one night, and it was a blood fest. And it was awesome because as passionate as these fans are, if you start throwing blood into a match, they just lose their fucking minds. And I remember just going and saying, wow, the drama buildup on this. And another aspect of this, too, is the announcing. I understand, Spanish probably as much as I understand Chinese. I actually understand a little bit of Spanish. But once they start, you know, commentating on the match, I'm picking up every 20th word, you know, I'm not really understanding what they're saying, but it's similar to the Japanese commentators, that it's the inflection in the voices. And it's when they start to raise their voices and they scream at times and they put emphasis on certain words, it makes it very dramatic. and it's very exciting. And I think, you know, there was a part here where they started, they're talking about the moves and they're describing the moves, and you hear the words like Gory Especial, which was the whole name for Gory Guerrero, or the Tope Suicida, which, you know, the suicide tope. So it's just kind of cool when you get to hear that and then you understand that aspect of it. But I guess in hindsight, I like this match a lot. This is not one of these matches that, in my opinion, is going to change or go, man, I've got to go watch every Lucha Libre match. At the same time, this is what wrestling should be in some ways, because the fans, they cater to their fans, and that's a big thing. And I think that's something in the U.S., and God knows you and I have talked about this. You know, the WWE, which, and the only, I reference the WWE because they're the biggest wrestling promotion in the world, but certainly in this country, they are the go-to wrestling promotion. They don't cater to their fans. You know, if anything, they kind of do the opposite. And I know I had this analogy months back that it's the only business that could essentially thumb their nose at the people who spend money and buy tickets and not give them what they want. Because if any other business did that, and I believe I used McDonald's, if McDonald's were serving a product and people hated it, McDonald's would quickly stop serving that product and give people something that they wanted. But for the WWE, you know, they push wrestlers and they shove them down people's throats. Their angles, you know, they'll do angles that are poorly received, but they don't give up on it. They'll stay with it for 6 months. And, you know, obviously Roman Reigns is a very polarizing figure. And Jeff, have you ever seen a Roman Reigns match?
Oh, sure. And, you know, I don't mean to interrupt your train of thought. You know, it's funny because the WWE seemingly doesn't give a shit about what people think about their main product, because they're pushing Roman Reigns, even though obviously he's getting a negative reaction. But on the other hand, in NXT, they give the product that everybody wants to see. And that's like such a weird dichotomy that like, okay, on our minor league product, we're going to give you people everything you fucking want. But on the major league product, fuck you. We're going to do what we want to do. And that's like so stinking weird, Barry.
It's beyond weird. And so here's the thing too. And people, you know, the easy answer to that is, well, Triple H does this and Vince, but that's not the answer. That makes zero sense. This is a publicly traded company. You have shareholders, you have a board. So how is it? And look, and I think Roman Reigns is unjustly vilified and booed. I don't get it. He's not a great interview. His in-ring work is absolutely fine. He's a lot better than a lot of other guys that are out there. So I don't really always get the hate on Roman Reigns. But that being said, if 95% of the audience is rejecting him, I mean, do something. But you have a board of directors. It's a publicly traded company. How is that allowed to continue? I mean, you know, if I was in my understanding of, you know, how all this shit works is minimal. So I'm certainly no expert on this. But if you have a board and you have decisions that are being made that people are not agreeing with, you know, there's a call to action with this. So for me, I can't figure out that Roman Reigns has been roundly rejected for the last 3-4 years. And it continues on the same path. Like, you know, where's the, and I think part of it is that they look and they go, okay, we're bringing in more revenue than ever before. But you look at the TV ratings, and that's a really interesting thing to me. And that's where somebody like Meltzer probably understands this a lot more than I ever will. But the ratings for Raw are at like a 20-year low. I mean, that's huge.
Yeah. And, you know, I will say one thing, you know, what you were saying about defending Roman Reigns. Yeah, Roman Reigns is not the guy he's not the booker that's doing this and is getting a negative reaction and going, fuck you. Much like Dusty around 87, 88 ish. He was getting that reaction, but he was the booker and said, screw you guys, I'm going to keep doing away. So, you know, Roman Reigns is just a guy that works for the company and they tell him what to do. And, you know, I don't really think he's got a lot of input on, you know, hey, I'm getting a shitty reaction from the fans, why don't you turn me? Because that's what they want. And if he is saying that, they're saying no. Okay. Now that being said, Barry, let's get back to the match we were talking about, the Atlantis versus Ultimate Guerrero match, before we get too far down that rabbit hole. When I watched this match, here's what I compared it to, and let me finish my train of thought before you immediately, not you, but the audience completely freaks out. This reminded me of WrestleMania 1 in the sense that as much of a match as this was, and as much of a match as that match was, it was more about the spectacle. in this match, while I think it was a better match than the WrestleMania 1 match, it was also on its equal in its own way to the just the sheer spectacle that you were watching, you know, the emotion of the crowd and the way the crowd was into literally every move, and the emotion of the unmasking in Mexico, and the way that it seemingly demasculinizes, you know, the person that loses the match and the mask, and now he has to wrestle without the match, that symbol of you know, machismo. And I think that's really interesting. This was their 81st anniversary show. I believe it's for a CMLL. And and one thing that I noticed, Barry, and I made a note about this, the old mask versus mask, you know, that's one thing that's really a lost part of wrestling in this country is, you know, when you and I were growing up, Barry, and into the, I want to say probably the, and I'm not talking about Kane and people like that. I'm talking about guys like the Masked Superstar and Mr. Wrestling 2 and, you know, the Super Destroyer and the Assassins and guys like that. The mask was such a, you know, such a great part of every promotion. The mask guy, Mr. Olympia in Mid-South. Think about all that. And I'm sure someone right now is going, you forgot about this guy, you fucking idiot. So, but Barry, I really wish we could bring back the mask guys and put them in a position where they mean something.
Yeah, and I don't see that ever happening.
No.
Obviously, the way the world is now. But you're right. It's, you know, look, the 1970s and then certainly 60s, 70s, and then a small portion, I guess, of the early 80s. There was a lot of emphasis on that. And the kind of the cool thing was, is that, you know, if you were to take a wrestler now and put a mask on him, everybody and their mother would know who he is. But back in those days, nobody knew who the Spoiler was, Don Jardine. I mean, you know, Don Jardine had a very limited career before he put on a mask. So it wasn't like if the mask had come off, we would have still probably sat there and said, who is that? Like, without having any idea. And Jody Hamilton is the Assassin. His entire career, the majority of his career was based around being an assassin. Only for a small portion in the beginning of his career was he Jody Hamilton. So had that mask come off, you know, it would have been, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is I think there was such a significance with the mask, their entire identities were built upon it. And nowadays you would never see that. It just, it wouldn't happen.
And so this match, there were, you know, Mexican wrestling, the Lucha Libre is an acquired taste. Barry kind of was hinting towards that. And it definitely wasn't. And I found myself getting into the Lucha Libre as Barry did in the early 80s. I'm sorry, the late 80s, early 90s. There was a lot more exposure to that product up until when Worlds Collide pay-per-view.
Oh, that was great.
Yeah, and I was into a lot of this stuff early, and then I kind of started fading out of it, which is not coincidentally when I started fading out of the U.S. wrestling scene for a couple of years. But and you're right about the announcers and the emotion that the announcers, as they say, máscara es más importante. You know, how important the masks are to the culture of Lucha Libre and everything. And the pops for the two counts, there were lots of two counts, especially in that third and deciding fall. Yeah. There were a lot of great moves. There was a great move where I think Ultimate Guerrero was coming off the top rope and Atlantis hit him with a drop kick as he's coming down. They did a headstand into a fall to the floor that was just great looking. What's great is when they unmask Ultimate Guerrero, hey, the match is 4 years old, if you don't know, you know, spoiler alert. But when they unmask him, his family's at ringside, and he goes out, and I think it's his mom and, like, his wife are at ringside. And he's sweating, and he's, like, you know, just – and his mom is, like, hugging him, and, like, you know, who doesn't need a hug from mom every once in a while, you know? And the wife is there, and tears are coming down her face. And Atlantis is celebrating, but he's not celebrating where it's, like – you know, I dare I say in the United States, there would be more of a gloat, you know, and this was more of a celebration that I had succeeded and vanquished my foe. Not that, you know, like he's a piece of crap and I beat him, you know, even though there was a, you know, the Technico and the Rudo aspect. I thought the way that was handled was very good. So, yeah, I think this match, Barry, you're not going to watch this and go, holy shit, this is, you know, a New Japan match that's going on now, or an NXT match that's a, you know, 5 or 6 star match. But what you will enjoy if you watch this is just watching the spectacle. I'm telling you, folks, and it reminded me of the match we had reviewed a while ago, Barry, the Sangre Chicana match that was that was mentioned to us that we had a chance to watch. And again, with this match, just the emotion, the crowd, I can't even state that enough, Barry, how they are completely drawn into this match and what's happening, and they just wear it on their sleeves. And I'm so jealous that you've got to watch a match at Arena Mexico. I would love to go down there and watch a match and just, you know, be part of that visceral emotional reaction that they give to the performers.
Yeah, so two thoughts on that. So one is I want to get back to Mexico. I know we talked about it at great length, but I was just blown away by my time in Mexico, in Mexico City too. It just literally, you know, I can't say enough good about it. And I was talking, I'm in a lot of restaurants every week, and I was talking with a lady from Mexico City last week, and we were talking about Mexico City, and I was telling her about my trip, and I just said, you know, I gotta be honest, I fell absolutely in love with the city. It was fantastic. But so here's the cool thing, two things, something touching on. Is there any other promotion, wrestling promotion in the world that has as many beautiful women ringside as any of the promotions in Mexico? Because they go out to the crowd several times, and there are some women that are, and I'm going to assume that they're plants. I don't, you know, maybe they're not, but at the same time, holy cow. Like, we're talking, you know, tens. These are tens sitting ringside. Absolutely incredible. The other aspect is that I don't think I talked about this when I was in Arena Mexico. They sell beer, they sell popcorn, they do hot dogs, they do tacos, but they also sell like fresh fruit. Like, the vendors will come around and they're selling like watermelon and sliced melons and fruit and grapes and stuff, which is unusual. But really what I was getting at is there didn't appear to be anybody drunk or inebriated, but the fans are super passionate. So it isn't like a Flaherty situation where somebody gets inebriated and then gets all crazy and passionate. These fans are already losing their minds, but I don't think alcohol actually plays a huge part of that.
It's just their emotion. I by the way, yeah. I got to give you a thumbs up on the it's a Flaherty situation.
I was hoping you were going to.
Yeah, I kind of popped for that. Okay, Barry, next match we're going to talk about two absolute legends of the game. We're going. Okay, now I'll give the date. I have December 1st, 1973. I believe this was in St. Petersburg. I think that was the day it was shown for whatever reason on Georgia Championship Wrestling. I think
maybe they were having a rematch, and I'm not 100% positive, but I think what it was, they filmed, because if you notice on this, when they filmed this, and this is from October, because I tagged you in Facebook on this one, I think they were doing the rematch, but this match was filmed, and I don't think this ever aired on Florida TV. So I think they filmed it so they could air it on Georgia TV for the rematch.
Yeah, that was the tag I got, that it was from Georgia Championship Wrestling. Yeah. So we're talking, of course, about the legendary Danny Hodge versus Jerry Briscoe. What's great about this match, before I throw it to you, Barry, is Gordon Solie does the introductions. He's the special ring announcer for this. And holy shit, does he put over Danny Hodge. And the fans in Florida – as great as Danny Hodge, Jerry Briscoe is the baby face in this match, but he puts over Danny Hodge as pretty much the second coming. And it's just really amazing. So, Barry, you had a chance to watch this. Now, I will say this match, it's about a 10-minute edit of this match, but you get a lot of stuff in this match. And, Barry, tell us what you thought.
Yeah, so I've seen this probably four or five times, and I remember the first time I saw it. And this is one of those two, and it's 10 minutes available. I think when they call the match at the end, it's like 16 and a half minutes. But we're able to see 10 minutes of it. I got to assume it's the best 10 minutes. At least I'm hopeful of that. But it's truly something to see for a bunch of different reasons. So one of my notes, my second note, is Gordon's ring introduction of Hodge prior to his match, listing his amateur credentials, added tremendously to the importance of this match. And it did. And he doesn't just talk about his professional accomplishments. He goes back to his amateur credentials. He's talking about his wrestling credentials. He's talking about his AAU boxing credentials. Gordon's in the ring for 5 minutes rattling off everything Danny Hodge has ever accomplished in his life. And boy, does that add something to this match. What makes that unique, in my opinion, is Danny Hodge had wrestled in Florida hundreds of times prior to this match. So it isn't like that. This is almost something that you would say for a newcomer. But at the same time, Hodge had been in the States since the early 60s. He'd wrestled Hiro Matsuda 50 to 100 times already at this point in the state of Florida. So I think he did it because the match was being filmed, and then it would lead up to the rematch. And it definitely works, though, because Gordon puts him over like nobody's business. This is, boy, do I love this match, too. And, you know, this is one of those that when you read the comments on YouTube, they're all over the map on this one. Some people are, this is the best professional wrestling I have ever seen. Others were, this is the most boring 10 minutes I've ever seen between two skinny white guys. That really legitimately was one of the comments. This is definitely one of those that I guess were extremely polarizing, and people had all these opinions on it. But for me, this is the way I like professional wrestling. And it's two baby faces. It's, you know, Danny Hodge, who is the NWA World's Junior Heavyweight Champion, and then Jerry Briscoe, who I believe they had called the number one contender. They're two baby faces, but as the match is taking place, Jerry Briscoe is the hometown baby face, and Danny Hodge is flipping over into this subtle heel, and then really kind of becomes a heel by the end of the match, and he's doing some definite heel moves in this. But this is the definition of snug wrestling, because when you watch the way that they're working together, there's that expression, light as a feather. You don't see that happening here. You see two guys who are working tight. And I mean, some of these flips that, you know, the way that they're flipping, there's one where Hodge flips over Jerry Briscoe and it's a headlock, but he's got him on his side for maybe 5 seconds. I mean, we're talking, he's flipping him over by his head. So these guys are working really, really tight. Hodge does this leg lock at the 4 minute mark. And I don't know what this leg lock was, Jeff. Do you know what I'm referring to?
No, I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah, it was.
I don't know if he's ever, I have never seen this leg lock before. It's the most intricate leg lock, but at the same time, I was completely blown away with it and go, my God, that should be a finisher. That is unbelievable. I mean, you think of like some of these finishers that were kind of tepid, you know, they're not exciting. And then you get this leg lock and I'm looking at this thing going, oh my God, that's incredible. Jerry gets, so the finish does come. Jerry gets Hodge in an airplane spin. Danny kind of flips him over and pins him. It's a great finish. It kind of catches everybody by surprise. It doesn't make Jerry look weak at all. It makes Danny seem like the cagey veteran being able to squeak out a win. I truly just love this match. This is one that I would go back and probably watch a couple more times because I really enjoy it. But, you know, a couple of notes I made on this one too. I met Danny Hodge only once in my life. He was at the, was it the 1980? It was either 1979 or, I guess it was 1979 WFIA convention in Memphis, Tennessee. And Danny was there. It was either there or it was Atlanta the next year, but I want to say it was Memphis in 79. And he was there, and he had retired at that point. That's another point we should bring up, too. This was within three years of this match, Danny had retired. He was in a car accident in, I believe it was Louisiana, and actually broke his neck. And he was forced to retire based off of that. So, yeah, there's a guy that I wonder – at the same time, how long would his career have gone on for? I don't, you know, would he have been a Lou Thesz in a sense and still wrestling into his, you know, 50s and possibly 60s? I know Thesz even had a match or two in his 70s, but you look at the shape of Danny Hodge, too. There's like, holy shit. This guy was in incredible shape. But I met Danny Hodge, and he was, of all things he was doing, Danny was selling a cookbook. And it was Danny Hodge's cookbook at the convention. And I actually bought a copy and he autographed it. And I still have it to this day. You know, I know a couple other people I've talked to that were at the convention also bought this cookbook. It's kind of cool. But when you watch this, Danny Hodge was a beast. You know, there's a lot of people say that, and there's not a lot of video footage of him. I believe there's only two matches on YouTube. But he was a beast, and he was a beast for a guy that weighed, you know, 210, 215 pounds. I think his announced weight was like 225, but wasn't a gigantic guy. But there is the myth of Danny Hodge. One is the tendon strength in the hands that, you know, he could rip a phone book in half. He could crush an apple with ease and smile at you as he's doing it. But, you know, a lot of people that know him, say that it, you know, if MMA was around during his prime, that he would have been completely unbeatable and unstoppable. And I don't know if that's true or that's not true, but I know that I've heard that. The other is, thing that I would bring up is Danny is a guy, unfortunately, that has some health issues. And, you know, he went through that scare, I guess it's 2 or 3 months back, where he disappeared overnight. And I believe he's got, it's either early Alzheimer's or a form of dementia. Danny's well into his 80s at this point. And that was very sad to hear. But there was an alert. You know, his status in Oklahoma, I believe there's even a statue of him in the town that he comes from in Oklahoma. You know, Danny is revered. He is, and he's the man in Oklahoma. So I know that, you know, there was like an all points bulletin out for him. Not just the silver alert, but, you know, if there were people out there trying to find him, and they found him. And, you know, I guess he just got disoriented and left, but, what a tremendous athlete. Yeah. A guy that I saw, I guess, towards the tail end of his career. I started going in 71. He was retired in 76. But in 75, Danny spent several weeks or months in Florida, 74 into 75. And he had a program with Toru Tanaka, Professor Tanaka, who injured him. I should say, actually, Buddy Colt had injured him prior to that. Then Tanaka had injured him. And he was around, he was a regular in 74 and 75. And then I think he did a couple of shots later in the year. And then by 76, he had retired. But, this is a guy I wish I could have seen in his prime more, because he was the definition of a wrestler. Just really something else.
Yeah. I don't think there is enough appreciation by not only our audience, but by, the American public, of what a tremendous once in a lifetime athlete that Danny Hodge was. As you know, I took a second to watch a clip that Jim Cornette had interviewed Bill Watts, sort of a quasi shoot interview, I guess. And he was asking him about Danny Hodge and who would win a match between Danny Hodge, a straight shoot between Danny Hodge and Kurt Angle. And, you know, and Watts was like, well, you know, and, you know, he was talking about it, but think about it, you know, you got Kurt Angle, who won a gold medal in Greco-Roman with a broken neck, or as Kurt used to say, a broken freaking neck. And Danny Hodge, who not only was he a Olympic athlete, who probably, based on some things that Bill said, should have, you know, won the gold medal in wrestling if it wasn't for some rather questionable officiating by the, I believe it was the East German official. So there, what a shock. But not only that, but you're talking about a guy that I believe between Olympic games, to maintain his amateur status, but to keep in shape, he decided to join the Golden Gloves. He became a Golden Gloves fighter, for God's sakes, you know, and won tournaments as a Golden Gloves boxer. So imagine that combination inside the octagon for the UFC. Who's going to fuck with this guy with the striking ability of a Golden Gloves boxer and then the technical ability of an Olympic class wrestler? You know, I don't see anybody, you know, and at the dinners that I used to attend that I don't anymore, they, you know, one of the questions that we would always ask is who's the guy that you want in a street fight? And Bill Watts said, you know, if you're talking about in a bar, you know, Danny Hodge is not going to be as effective as a Harley Race or a Dick Slater or a Haku. But, you know, you put him in a structured sports setting. I'm not really sure that in his prime that Kurt Angle could have taken Danny Hodge in his prime, even with a what is probably a weight advantage for Kurt. And I think, you know, would somebody the size of Lesnar have given him problem? But, you know, they say that Angle was real close to taking care of Lesnar. So, you know, I think while Lesnar would certainly have a size advantage on Hodge, I just I don't know that there's an appreciation for just how good Danny Hodge was as an athlete. And, you know, just as a way of showing that, every year the outstanding college wrestler in this country is given the Dan Hodge Award for a guy that wrestled amateur 50, 60 years ago. That's how good he was that his name is still remembered in college wrestling.
And he's been, you know, and from the pro game, he's been retired for 42 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, so definitely, you know, that's the sad part is, you know, understanding the history of professional wrestling. And for some people, it's, you know, for me, you know, look, before we got on air today, we had a 20-minute conversation with our producer, the great Brian Last, where we talked about the wrestling war in Atlanta. And it was really just three guys discussing history that occurred 46 years ago, because it's something that interests us. And I know that for some people, you know, wrestling history begins and ends with the NWO, Chris Saha, 20 years ago. But, you know, for a lot of people, they'll go back. And when you see something like Danny Hodge, to me, it's important because you're not only seeing a guy that could have kicked your ass professional wrestling, could have ripped your neck, you know, literally right off your shoulders. But here was a guy who was an AAU boxer on top of that. And here was a guy that was also on the cover of Sports Illustrated at one point.
And he was on the cover of Sports Illustrated, not as a Hulk Hogan pro wrestler, quote unquote. He was right. He was on Sports Illustrated as a Olympic athlete, Olympic wrestler in Golden Gloves as a guy that this was a guy when you step inside a squared circle or an octagon, you do not want to fuck with this guy in his prime. Trust me, folks. So
this is great. Yeah, this really is a great match, and this is one that I am going to, and it's going to be funny because when we hang up, I always have this routine, Jeff, after we finish our shows. I immediately go up and I walk my dog Ozzy. I order a large pepperoni pizza, but tonight I'm going to change it up. I'm actually going to bring Zach down to the basement, and I'm going to try to put this leg hold on him that I see Danny Hodge doing at the 4-minute mark because I've never seen anything like this before.
Well, if you come up in criminals under child abuse on poor Zach there, he's going to college in a few
ass.
Months.
Probably. He could kick my ass if he wanted to. So.
He probably could. The last thing I want to say about this match, and we'll move on, is as you were talking about the finish of the match, I found it in some ways similar. We talked about I think a week or two ago about the Flair Steamboat match from Nashville. The finish to this match is sort of similar to that, and the Steamboat match, he had him up in a body slam, and Flair turned it into a roll up. And that's what Hodge does in this match. And, you know, again, the crafty veteran, as you said, that's a good analogy, you know, winning one over the young upstart Jerry Briscoe. But yeah, a great match. Just really to put it in the context of the historical, you know, the importance of Danny Hodge, not only to the sport of quote unquote professional wrestling, but wrestling in general, Barry, just a true, mountain of a figure in the sport of wrestling.
Yeah, it's, you know, I can't say enough good about Danny. And I don't think, you know, I think from my standpoint, I'm not quite sure that I appreciated Danny Hodge when I was seeing him, because when I saw him and really I'll go back to that 74-75 period, he was mid-card, but he was more prelim. And he was winning these matches. He was kind of like a prelim special attraction. He was this veteran that could probably have taken anybody on the card, you know, in a shoot. But at the same time, he was definitely towards, I guess, the tail end of his career. He was already in his mid-40s or, you know, I forget exactly how old he was. So I think Eddie Graham had the respect for Hodge that I'm going to give him work. He's going to work here. I think he enjoyed being in the state of Florida because he stuck around for months. But it was really, you know, he was the first, second, and third match. So it wasn't like he was, you know, in all these main events. At the same time, I don't think I had that appreciation for him because it was the way that his matches were being structured. However, in hindsight and going back, and there's a great story in the Irish Pat Barrett autobiography that he published some 25, 30 years ago. And I think it was called Everybody Down Here Hates Me. And it's a story about Irish Pat Barrett and Danny Hodge in Mexico. And I don't remember the story. I remember it's got some really graphic language of words that you and I have never even used on this podcast. Yeah, there's only like two that I think we've never used, and it's one of those words. And I think it's Danny, and I'm going to be very careful with this. I believe in this story. I haven't read this book in 20 years, but this stayed with me. Danny had a staph infection, or he had some sort of open wound on his leg that he was comparing to a woman's private parts.
Oh my.
And, yeah, exactly. And I could get this book and find this for next week's episode, but maybe I shouldn't. But in any case, so they were discussing this, and Danny, I think the context of the story was Danny should have been in the hospital having this tended to. Instead, he's wrapped and taped this up, and he's going out and he's having his match. And that was what the whole story was really about. So, just an incredible guy, and just sad that, you know, because it's been 42 years and he didn't make it into the next wave of professional wrestling with mainstream exposure, you know, and things like that. And there is no video footage. He's largely forgotten, except for those that knew him, or if you're from Oklahoma.
Yeah,
and it shouldn't be that way.
And I will say that I actually had the chance to meet him and shake his hand. I was glad he didn't squeeze my hand at a CAC a few years back. And
very cool.
Yeah, just it was such a pleasure. And, you know, you told the story about him squeezing the apples. And you know, the other gimmick that he would do back in the day was he would break pliers with just his bare hands. And, you know, the tendon strength was just off the charts. Okay, we could spend a lot more time talking about the legend of Danny Hodge. Before we get to our top five list, folks, Barry, I texted you today and said, I'm going to throw a new segment out there. This is quick and easy, light and breezy, Barry. Mrs. Bowdrin picked me up a book called 3,000 Would You Rather Questions. So, Barry, are you ready to do a little Would You Rather?
I, so before we do this, how is Mrs. Bowdrin holding up with her youngest child, about to be betrothed in about 2.5 weeks? It has got to be the most nerve-wracking thing she's ever gone through.
I'm just going to say there's a little bit of stress involved in the 3 to 4 times a day call. And my daughter, the lovely Kelly, the other day, get a load of this, folks, calls my wife and says, there's a problem. There is a problem. My wife says, what's the problem? I don't like the chairs that they're going to use. I asked for a particular type of chair, and now they're going to use another. And, you know, it's that kind of stuff. And I'm just like, don't sweat the small stuff. However, I will point out, and I'm not going to go into a huge tangent because otherwise this will be a 4-hour episode. We recently found out that we are going to be on our, I think it's number 5 on the wedding planner at the site. Yeah, number 5. We've dealt now with our 5th person, who, by the way, is the wedding planner that's now there organizing the event. Oh, and tells my daughter, yeah, by the way, I'm not going to be there that day. But somebody will be there that day. So, yeah, the Bowdrins are not real happy with the wedding planner situation, but we're hoping that all things will go without a glitch. Thank you for asking, Barry. Just a little bit of stress in the Bowdrin family life right now. Barry, would you rather – I'll throw these are quick. I'll throw a few out at you here, Barry.
Sure.
Here's an example. Barry, would you rather eat your ice cream sundae with or without a cherry?
Oh, with a cherry.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Barry, would you rather eat more vegetables or fruit?
Fruit.
Yeah, I'm going to go fruit, as I think you could probably guess, folks. With my salad habits, very well known. Let's see. Would you rather go back 5 years or skip ahead 5 years in your life, Barry?
At my age, I really don't want to skip ahead 5 years. You're asking a 54-year-old guy. Don't you want? No, I want to go back 30 years, but sure, I'll go back 5 years. That's fine.
Okay. Barry, and now I know these are not places that you like to go to, as we discussed on a previous episode. Barry, Big Mac or Quarter Pounder?
Okay. So with a caveat on this one, if you had asked me this question a year ago, I would have said Big Mac. I like McDonald's, by the way. I go once a week. However, they're Quarter Pounders now, Jeff, and I don't know if you're aware of this. They're using fresh meat that's not been frozen, and there is a big difference. A year ago, the Big Mac. Currently, Jeff, the Quarter Pounder with cheese, no mustard.
Okay, thank you. Summer or Winter Olympics, Barry?
For me, my entire life is anything summer, so yeah, absolutely summer.
Okay. Our last would you rather for this week, Barry, and I'm going to
make it good, Jeff.
Okay.
Make it good.
Would you rather text only in GIF or emoji?
Oh, GIF. I fucking hate emojis.
And I say that because I have a friend that both of us know.
Sure.
I'm not going to mention his name. but it rhymes with Tom Nash, who will respond to you only in emojis on Facebook. And it's absolutely hilarious. It just cracks me up. All he does is talk in emojis. And it's just, I think it's so funny that he does that. Now, Barry, it is time for our top five list as demanded by the fan base, Barry. They said, we want more of your pre-1970 favorite films. So Barry and I have come up with another top five list. Barry, so much reaction. And as you and I were preparing this list, folks, we may even do the rare part three if we get a positive enough reaction. So Barry, we're talking five more of our favorite films from before 1970. Give me your number five.
Yeah, two. And this is just a five. These are just five random movies that I truly enjoy, that if they're on cable, I'll watch them. But my number five is, as I flip over my sheets, is from 1963. It's Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. So when we talked about this last time, I put Psycho on. I feel Psycho is just a tremendous movie. But The Birds is great. And it's really just great for me because this was a scary movie when I was a kid. You know, I remember watching this when I was a kid, and I remember coming home one day from school and it was on regular TV. And I remember going, wow, this is really scary. This was Tippi Hedren's first film. And if you don't know what The Birds is, and I got a feeling, Jeff, you know, of all the films I'm going to talk about, everybody knows, but Tippi Hedren is, kind of has this thing for Rod Taylor and follows him to this small little Northern California town called Bodega Bay. And then everything takes this turn for the bizarre when these birds go on the attack. So this was her first film, Tippi Hedren. And she did a great job. I think she won some award that year for like most promising newcomer. And if I'm correct, Tippi Hedren is Melanie Griffith's mother. If I'm correct with that too. So I really enjoy this movie. This was the eighth highest grossing film of the year. And Jeff, I toss this back to you. What do you think in 1963 the highest grossing film of the year was?
I am going to take a shot and say Goldfinger.
You know what? It absolutely should have been. And no, it wasn't. It's a movie that nobody will ever talk about. It was Cleopatra. That it was the Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor movie, Cleopatra, that apparently was terrible. I've never seen it. But, you know, it is.
It will not be discussed on this episode.
I doubt it. But, yeah, so for me, in any case, you know, it was The Birds.
Yeah, and it's a great movie. And Tippi Hedren was also in the Hitchcock movie Marnie with Sean Connery.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, and a good film, lots of fun, and yeah, it gives you a little creepy look at nature having its way with mankind. You know, it's kind of scary shit. So, okay, my number five is from 1962, Gregory Peck in To Kill a Mockingbird. And boy, Barry, I said I shit the bed last week, forgetting about this one, because what an epic, epic movie this is. And you know, Gregory Peck winning the Best Actor Award at the Academy Awards. It also won Best Writing. It was a nominee for Best Picture. The girl that played Scout apparently retired after one role. You know, it's just, you know, it's, we're talking about the kid that was on Game of Thrones that played Joffrey, and the right. role was so iconic that he decided never to act again. And that's the way that it happened with the girl that played Scout in this. And this is the story of Atticus Finch, a lawyer in the Deep South, the old, dare I say, racist South, as it was at that time. And he's called upon to defend a black man against a charge of rape against a white woman. And, you know, as I was going through the Barry, I started looking at this, the cast of this. Here's a guy that we didn't mention in great support, Brock Peters, who played who played Tom Robinson in this movie, not to be confused with any other Tom Robinsons that we may know. But he played a guy named Tom Robinson who was accused of, and Brock Peters was such a solid supporting actor. Every time you saw him in a movie, he did a great job. And he, you know, I want to point him out. Also, Alice Ghostly. Alice Ghostly.
Bewitched.
Remember her from Bewitched. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. And this was the first appearance of Robert Duvall. He played Boo Radley, And Boo Radley, it had no dialogue, but Robert Duvall's performance was so well remembered. And it's amazing that he was able to convey such emotion, and he didn't have one line of dialogue. And the girl that played Scout, I'm sorry, her name was Mary Badham. Mary Badham never acted again after Scout, but she and Gregory Peck remained friends for as long as they can remember. And as a matter of fact, the impact that this movie had, Brock Peters, Barry, I read today, gave the eulogy at Gregory Peck's funeral. And I believe it was 2003. Harper Lee's amazing story, To Kill a Mockingbird, turned into an amazing movie starring Gregory Peck. That's my number five. Got an 8.3 on the IMDb scale, Barry. So what's your number four?
That's an excellent movie. So my number four is 1933, Jeff. I'm going back to the year I was born, 1933. The movie King Kong. So this is the original King Kong. This is not the Peter Jackson remake or the one that starred the great Jeff Bridges and Jessica Lange. This is the original that stars Faye Ray and Robert Armstrong. And this is one of those movies that, you know, definitely goes back to my youth. You know, again, at our age, and I'm including you in that group, Jeff, at our age, we didn't have a lot of TV channels. We had really four channels. You know, sometimes you had a fifth on a UHF. That's all you had. You didn't have a VCR. So you watched what was on, or you didn't watch TV. And King Kong was one of those movies that would kind of, it was iconic, and kind of like Wizard of Oz, where every year it would play. And when it was going to be on, people gathered around the TV to watch. And this, I'm talking some 45 years later, that people were still gathering around to watch this movie. So to me, King Kong, the original, it's such a great movie. You know, if you don't know what it's about, I don't know if I can help you. But you know, right? I mean, if I have to sit here and describe what the movie's about, we have an issue. I'll give you two facts about it, which will make it a little more interesting. So the movie was filmed in and around Los Angeles, which was really substituting for the jungles and New York City, but everything was filmed really in and around Los Angeles, which I find absolutely incredible.
It was not filmed in Jerry Jarrett's backyard like the Kamala videos.
Right. No, that was actually really funny, too. In 2004, Faye Ray was approached by director Peter Jackson to appear in a very small cameo role for the 2005 remake that Peter Jackson was filming. She got to meet with the lead star, Naomi Watts, who would have been playing the same character that Faye Ray played, which was Ann Darrow. Faye Ray politely declined the cameo and claimed that the original Kong was the true king. Before filming of the remake started, Faye Ray died in her sleep of natural causes on August 8th, 2004 in her Manhattan apartment, 1 month shy of her 97th birthday. So, you know, what a life she led too. You know, she starred in many different movies, but this movie to me is great. And, you know, for whatever, and I don't want to call them flaws, whatever perceived flaws, which really are not flaws, I feel it makes the movie. This movie is not as slick as, say, that remake in 2005 from Peter Jackson, which actually was an okay movie. I don't have an issue. I hated the one with Jeff Bridges and Jessica Lange. To me was just a pointless remake. And really, most remakes are pointless. But the original Kong, if you've never seen it, should go out of your way, because it's got this really cool tone and vibe to it from the 30s. And it definitely is a movie, I think, that everybody, if you're into film, and God knows, looking at our Facebook group, Jeff, everybody's into film in our Facebook group, which I think is fantastic. This is such a wonderful movie.
Yeah, and it is a absolute, back in the day, Barry, it was an absolute staple of any creature feature type program that you had. Yeah. And anywhere USA, here in South Florida, of course, Barry, because you grew up here, you remember guys like Arnie Warren and Big Wilson and Dave Dixon would do the creature features. And King Kong was seemingly on a loop on those shows. It was always on. It was a great movie. And, you know, you were talking about Faye Ray and what a long, wonderful life she had. Barry, my number four movie is from 1938. And what I tried to do, I made a deliberate point of trying to include a movie from each decade, the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. From 1938, The Adventures of Robin Hood, starring Errol Flynn and Olivia de Havilland. Olivia de Havilland, Barry, 102 years old, still alive. She made a movie in fucking 1938, people, and she's still with us. God bless Olivia.
Let me tell you about this. Olivia de Havilland apparently has all of her faculties and wits about her, and she's suing the network FX. And I read it, and I swear to God, 102 years old, she's suing the network of FX. They did a show, and I guess they portrayed her in a negative light. I don't know exactly what the show was, and she's suing them.
So, I bet you, I know, Barry, I bet you it had something to do. She had a legendary, lifelong feud with her sister, Joan Fontaine.
That's what it was, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm betting, it had something to do with that. But Olivia de Havilland, by the way, in this movie, she literally spends the entire movie wearing like a cloak because, of course, the movie is set in Robin Hood in like the 11th century. So it's not like she's out there in a bathing suit, but she was absolutely gorgeous for her time and just an amazing looking woman. This film was a nominee for Best Picture. It won awards for editing and score. This was much like the way that The Wizard of Oz, just the Technicolor on the film print just screamed at you. The Technicolor in The Adventures of Robin Hood just screamed at you. Errol Flynn was at the top of his game as an action film star at that point. We could do an entire episode on Errol Flynn and some of the stories that were out there about him. What a life that guy led, huh? So, just an amazing action film. So many great character actors. Alan Hale Sr., Olivia de Havilland. Just a great film. And what a great way on a rainy Saturday or Sunday to kill a couple of hour and a half to 2 hours. Still, a movie that's 80 years old, Barry, that I can still watch because it's just tons of fun.
Yeah, it is. It's a great movie too. And she's such a great actress as well, Olivia de Havilland. She goes back to those days of again, you're talking about a movie that she made 80 something years ago, but she was Hollywood royalty. And to me, there are a few periods, people always, I remember years ago, and I think I told this story, and I couldn't tell the full story, and I still can't. And this was on the first or second episode, and I was dating a girl at the time that we were watching The Deer Hunter one night. And I remember I was telling you this, and she said to me, and I was very immature at the time, and I didn't grasp it, and she goes, if I could go back into any period of U.S. history, it would be the Vietnam War era. And in my head, I think I was 18 years old when we were dating. I think I was 18 when we were dating, actually, or 19, I forget, but I was very immature, and I didn't grasp what she was saying, and I was like, why the fuck would you want to go back to a period where there's all this war? That's like the craziest thing ever. Of course, she was talking about the free love and just, hippies and all that shit, and I didn't get that, but if you said to me, could you go back in any period in U.S. history, where would you want to go? And it would probably be Los Angeles in the 40s or 50s, maybe right after World War II, when there was a boom, a film boom out in Los Angeles, because people like Olivia de Havilland and Errol Flynn, and there were just all these just amazing actors and luminaries, and it was like the Wild West almost. I mean, there was like orgies every night, and you read these stories and you go, my God, this would have been like the most amazing place. So to me, I'm just fascinated by old Hollywood.
Okay, Barry, give us your number three.
You don't want to explore that anymore about the Hollywood origin?
We're such a conservative show, Barry. Why would we do that?
Yeah, exactly. We've been on very, very good behavior the last couple of weeks too. I'm not sure why. we need to explore that and figure out why we've been on such good behavior. So my number three movie is from 1951, the year I was born, Jeff. The Day the Earth Stood Still. Have you ever seen this film?
I have.
It is a fantastic film. So in a nutshell, this is an alien spaceship is landed in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., but it's not what you think with the usual take us to your leader type of thing. It's played by actor Michael Rennie. He's a human-like alien. He comes out offering input on what's going on in the universe, but is immediately attacked by the humans and taken hostage. He plays a character, Michael Rennie, called Klaatu, And he tries to explain several times that he's not here to hurt anybody, but the humans, they don't trust him. So he escapes. He winds up with this family, and they think he's just a regular guy who needs a place to stay. They think he's a little strange, but very polite and nice. But when they learn of his true identity, you know, a lot goes down with this too. So Michael Rennie, to me, was so perfect in this role. And while this is a good movie, and this is almost a Twilight Zone type of movie to me in some ways, and I can definitely see where something like The Monsters or Due on Maple Street, there's a little bit of this movie in that episode from the Twilight Zone. But to me, Michael Rennie is the star of this movie. And then I was really surprised as I'm doing research, Michael Rennie was not the first choice to play this character. It was Claude Rains, the great actor Claude Rains, who I'll actually be discussing in one of my other films coming up shortly. He was the first, and Michael Rennie was not, but Michael Rennie got it. He did an amazing job, and this is one of those movies that when I watch, this is true science fiction to me right here, and this is that 50s kind of science fiction that I just think is so cool. It's a time capsule of the era. So I just love this movie. Unfortunately, they don't really play it on cable too often. I believe I saw it on Amazon Prime because I watched it within the last year. I had a night where I watched this movie and then I watched Angel about the teen hooker in Los Angeles the same night.
It's a nice dichotomy.
So, yeah. Exactly, right, exactly. You know, like it's, you know, a big difference here. But just this is just such a fantastic movie.
And, you know, I was thinking his character, Cletu, if I recall, I want to say 70s, wasn't there a band called Cletu? And everyone thought it was the Beatles, like working under a gimmick. And it was really, you know, John, Paul, George, and Ringo. But they didn't want to say it was that was like the big story I remember in the mid 70s was that Cletu was actually the Beatles. And they had like, I don't know, like one or two hit records. It was, I don't know why the hell that just came to me. So, Barry, my number three movie is from 1959. It is director Howard Hawks, Rio Bravo with John Wayne. And, you know, I talked last time about the John Wayne film, The Searchers, and how I thought that was John Wayne's finest acting performance his name was Ethan. I can't remember his last name, but he was the anti-hero in that. And here, this is John Wayne with his little sidewalk that he's got going. And he's got Dean Martin as the drunk sheriff. And Ricky Nelson and Angie Dickinson. Oh my God, Barry, is Angie Dickinson smoking hot in this stinking movie? You also got Walter Brennan, Ward Bond. It is just the proverbial who's who of character actors that were pretty much in John Wayne's camp. He always had great supporting performances. So here you got Dean Martin playing the drunk sheriff, and Ricky Nelson's the young gunfighter named Colorado. And it was funny. I read, Barry, that as a sort of a initiation into the film, where this might have been Ricky Nelson's first film, his 18th birthday took place during filming, and John Wayne and Dean Martin threw a bag of manure on top of him to help him celebrate. Yes, you know, what are friends for, kind of thing, you know. But what I found interesting was reportedly, although, as I said, Ricky Nelson, Garden Party Ricky Nelson, was the person that portrayed Colorado, the young gunslinger. Barry, do you know who the role was initially offered to?
Claude Rains.
That's a good guess, but I say no.
All right. Who was it?
Elvis Presley. And Elvis wanted the role, but the old Colonel Tom Parker, not Robert Fuller, not that Colonel Parker,
right.
Colonel Parker declined on behalf of Elvis, and Elvis apparently really wanted that role. So it's too bad. One of the things that's interesting is John Wayne, apparently at age 51, younger than you and I when he played this role, Barry, that's just sad, was a little leery about playing the romantic aspect with Angie Dickinson, who was 26 years old. And Barry, again, let me just say how amazing Angie Dickinson was in this role. And she just looked absolutely beautiful. Barry, tell me the trivia that I'm thinking about why this movie would appeal to Barry Rose because of one particular piece of trivia. It has to do, I'll just say it has to do with Dean Martin in this performance.
Martin. So what would my...
What is Dean Martin's character's name in this movie, Barry?
Patrick Swayze.
Dude!
Oh, it's the dude? I was going to say, it's either that or Jumbo Sharuda. So it's
his name is Dude in this. And I was like, how did Barry not have this on the shelf at home? So yeah, Rio Bravo, 1959, gets an 8.0 on the old IMDb scale. A great, fun, quality Western. And this is not one where you got to sit and think about. This is just sit back, have a good time, and enjoy it, Barry. So give us your number two.
Absolutely. So my number two, I go back to 1944, and Claude Rains does make an appearance in this one. It is Casablanca. So Casablanca is I probably should have had this on my five favorite films prior to 1970 when we did it. So I definitely had to include it into this one too. So my first exposure to Casablanca was very odd. It was, Jeff, do you remember an attraction in Orlando called the Stars Hall of Fame?
I do not.
So it was gone by, I believe, by 1985, it was gone. But around 72, 73, 74, when Disney World was very small, you know, you had two hotels, you had the Magic Kingdom, and you had the shopping complex, and that was it. You know, now Disney obviously is a fully functioning city with you could spend a year there and still not see everything. But back in those days, they really didn't have a lot. When I say that, you had the Magic Kingdom, you had the hotels, you had the shopping village, but that was it. So you had other attractions in the area. And one of those, you had Circus World, which became Boardwalk and Baseball. But the other one was Stars Hall of Fame, and it was essentially a Hollywood-style wax museum in the city of Orlando. It was right off of I-Drive, and it was fascinating to me to go because it was somewhere that my parents took me as a kid, and then even as I got a little bit older, I always went back to it because the way it was designed, it was a lot of fun, and it was a really, really cool place to go. But that was my first exposure to Casablanca, and it's the scene where they're in front of the airplane. You know, remember the scene in front of the airplane?
Of course, yeah, it's a classic.
Yeah, so
classic
they're in front of the airplane, and I still to this day even have the postcard from the Stars Hall of Fame where they're in front of that airplane. So that was my first exposure to it, and then as I got older, I actually watched the movie, and I remember I watched it with an old girlfriend, and I remember when it was over, like I was like weepy. Like, I don't know what it was, but I was like, this movie really had an impact on me and really, really touched me. So if you don't know what this movie's about, and I got a feeling, again, our group is, you know, say what you want. We may be all fucking psychos, but this is an extremely knowledgeable group. But it's basically, it's a nightclub owner, Rick's American Cafe. He's protecting his old girlfriend and her husband from Nazis in Morocco. Casablanca, obviously, being Morocco. Humphrey Bogart plays Rick. Ingrid Bergman plays his old girlfriend.
Beautiful.
Stunning. Absolutely. I'll tell you a great story, and I'll make this quick. So living in New York City for years, you just have to walk down the street and you'll run into people. And one night my wife and I were downtown, and we were somewhere in an area, somewhere downtown, but like way downtown, like not like the Greenwich Village area. Like we were way downtown, and we're walking down a street, and here comes Isabella Rossellini. And she asked us for directions to the nearest subway station. And that was a pretty cool fucking moment.
I thought you were going to say a subway restaurant. That would have been funny.
That would have been right. She's looking for a foot long, Jeff. You know, she wanted, right. So
and it's you're just the man to provide it to her.
Absolutely. And I think my wife would have given me the hall pass for that one. So she was absolutely stunning. She looks just like her mother. And this is going back 20, 25 years ago, obviously. But I just thought that was a cool moment. But Ingrid Bergman, my God, just a stunning woman. But this movie is a work of art. You know, like my number one pick is one of my favorite movies of all time. But it's not a work of art. But this movie really is a work of art. This movie won 3 Oscars. It won Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Writing for the screenplay. Humphrey Bogart and Claude Rains were both nominated for Best Actor and Supporting Actor. Neither won. So Ingrid Bergman's husband in the movie was played by an actor named Paul Henreid. And he apparently did not get along well with his fellow actors. He considered Bogart a mediocre actor, and Ingrid Bergman in later years called him a prima donna. I'll tell you a guy who stands out in this movie for me also is Sidney Greenstreet as Signor Ferrari. I'm just so taken with Sidney Greenstreet. To me, he's such a compelling looking actor. When you look at him, he just looks fucking cool. I just thought he was cool. Do you know Sidney Greenstreet, who knew Peter Lorre and Humphrey Bogart? They had also worked together in The Maltese Falcon. But he didn't start working in movies until the age of 62, and his career lasted less than a decade.
Wow.
I mean, that's like surprising to me.
Several iconic roles, that goes without saying. An amazing actor, an amazing movie. It's even more amazing when you read the backstory on the making of the film, that there were like 5 to 10 writers, because they kept firing writers as they were doing the script. It was just absolutely crazy. And like Ingrid Bergman, this movie and Notorious that she made, I think, in 1946, which was actually one of the movies that I was thinking about putting on my list. That's another amazing performance, and just shows how beautiful Ingrid Bergman really was at this point. And that's a tremendous movie. And that's another one that's as great as the movie is. It's also such a fun movie with the performances by Sidney Greenstreet and Peter Lorre. And as you mentioned, Claude Rains. Round up the usual suspects. I can't believe there's gambling here in Casablanca. I did not know about it. And, and then of course the line that everyone messes up, play it again. Everyone says it thinks it's play it again, Sam. It's not. It play it one more time, Sam, you know, or something like that. But no, that's a great movie. My number two movie, 1949. If you were to ask me to name the greatest gangster film of all time, of course, you know, when you ask that question, people immediately say The Godfather, Goodfellas, Casino, one of those kind of films. But for my money, 1949's White Heat by director Raoul Walsh and starring James Cagney and Virginia Mayo as he plays the psychopathic criminal Cody Jarrett. Barry, have you ever seen this movie?
I have seen it. Absolutely.
Oh my God. It's fucking amazing. He plays, and what's really amazing is Cagney did not consider this a great performance. He thought it was a very, he's kind of a thug, not really that an inspired character, but Cody Jarrett, first of all, for those of you that have never seen this movie, do me a favor and go out and watch this movie, because it's absolutely friggin' amazing, especially if you like crime dramas, and because Cody Jarrett is a complete nut. And there's so many scenes in this movie that the character, apparently when the story was written, it was inspired by the story of Ma Barker and her sons, the famous gangster from the 1930s. There's a scene in the movie, I won't spoil it, where Cody Jarrett is in prison. And he gets some bad news. Let's just say it without revealing what he finds out. But he gets some bad news. And apparently when the scene was shot, he and director Raoul Walsh had decided they weren't going to tell the other people. And we're talking about a scene in like a lunchroom at prison or the dining hall. So there's like literally 100 people there. And he gets up and just completely loses his mind. And the reactions from the actors in the scene are visceral, because they didn't know he was going to do that, because they didn't tell the actors that James Cagney was going to freak out and do the scene, which makes it a really amazing scene to watch. There's another scene where he puts a guy, I think he realizes the guy's a stool pigeon, and he puts him in the trunk. The guy doesn't know he's been fingered, and he puts him in the trunk, and the guy's like, from inside the trunk, he says, "Hey, how am I going to breathe in here? How am I going to get air?" And Cody Jarrett says, Oh, you want air? Well, let me give you some ventilation. And he begins shooting the trunk while the guy's in the trunk. And it's just absolutely crazy. The movie is best remembered, Barry, for what was chosen by the American Film Institute as the number 18 movie quote of all time. Barry, do you remember what that quote is?
I don't.
Top of the world, Ma! Top of the world.
Which is the same quote For a minute there, I thought you were going to say, "I wonder who fingered me," because you, right? I was wondering that. Because if you don't know who's fingering you, you definitely have an issue. But top of the world, Ma, you know where that also, I mean, obviously he took it from Cagney, but you know who also used that, right?
Don't right now. So why don't you?
Andrew Dice Clay.
Oh, okay.
So Andrew, when Andrew Dice Clay was on stage, and I think it was the concert when he was at Madison Square Garden, in the middle of his act, he just said, "Top of the world, Ma, top of the world." Because, you know, at one point, Andrew Dice Clay was on top of the world. Wow.
And finally, this film was selected also by the American Film Institute as the number 4 gangster film of all time, 1949, White Heat. Go out of your way and find this movie. It's absolutely unbelievable. Okay, Barry, your number 1 choice for part 2 of our best pre-1970 movies.
Yeah, and before I say this also, we don't talk enough about James Cagney and what an incredible actor. Oh, that guy, he could have done anything, and he just would have been. And I think the last movie he made, I want to say, was it Ragtime?
Yes, like 1981-ish, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And he was definitely an older guy. He played the police commissioner, yeah. And that's with Elizabeth McGovern.
Howard Rollins Jr.
Yeah, what a powerful movie. But Cagney, even at his advanced age, was just, you know, he's on screen, he owns it, that's his screen. Yeah, so my number one movie, Jeff, 1968's Planet of the Apes. And boy, do I love this movie. And we're talking about the original Planet of the Apes, none of the remakes, none of the sequels that followed, though I enjoyed the sequels. But that original is to me, mind-blowing filmmaking for the time. The fact that makeup was absolutely incredible. If you don't know what this one's about, an astronaut crew crash lands on a planet led by Charlton Heston. The distant future where intelligent talking apes are the dominant species and humans are the oppressed and enslaved. And it's such a great movie. It's got a massive twist at the end, I guess being 50 years. There's probably not much of a spoiler. I mean, but exactly. It's been 50 years. I think we can go ahead, but there's a massive twist at the end. And then, as I'm doing the research, of course, why is there a twist like this at the end? Because one of these screenwriters, there were two writers. One of the screenwriters was Rod Serling from the Twilight Zone. So it's definitely, that ending is 100% Twilight Zone-esque. And I assume we have to give Rod Serling a lot of credit for that. This was the 9th highest grossing film of the year. Number 1 was 2001, A Space Odyssey. I'll give you a little fact. If you remember the character that Charlton Heston, the female that he was with, I think her name was Zora, if I'm correct. But
Kim
she
Hunter.
Was played by that's right. Kim Hunter was she was the ape, but
You're talking about Linda.
The woman. Linda Harrison. She's an 11 on a scale of a 1 to 10. She's just absolutely stunning and sexy and gorgeous. And, even to this day, looking, you know, going back and looking at her 50 years ago, just absolutely incredible. But she was married to the producer, of this movie, which is Richard Zanuck. And she was originally supposed to be Roy Scheider's wife in Jaws. But as it turns out, because her husband was producing the movie, but it turns out that Universal chief Sid Sheinberg wanted his own wife, who's Lorraine Gary, to have the part. And since Sheinberg was Zanuck's boss, Lorraine Gary got it. But originally, Linda Harrison, I think, was slated to be the wife there. I don't know if that would have worked, and I only say it. I think she was so stunningly beautiful, it would have detracted in the scene she was in. I think she was too hot. Lorraine Gary seemed like somebody's mother to me. I don't watch that and go, wow, you know, the focus is on Roy Scheider. The focus is on Bruce the Shark. So, I guess in retrospect with all this, if Linda Harrison had gotten that role, I think she would have overshadowed anybody that she was in a scene with. Again, Lorraine Gary, she did a fine job. I think she was more suited for that role than, say, Linda Harrison would have been. But Linda Harrison, I don't really know if she was a great actress at all. I'd have to assume that maybe she wasn't, because she didn't really say a lot in Planet of the Apes, obviously. And I don't know what else she did afterwards, but I can tell you when I watched that movie, I'm spellbound by her beauty, just completely taken with her.
Okay. We are now going to go to my number one choice this week, and it is from 1969. Just getting in under the old limit there, Barry. Getting a 7.7 on the old IMDb scale. One of my favorite World War II type of war movies, and that is from a book by Alistair MacLean called Where Eagles Dare with Richard Burton and Clint Eastwood. Have you ever seen this movie, Barry?
I have, years ago, yep. But I did see it. Yep.
And this is another one that's just, a White Heat that I mentioned at number two is just an epic filmmaking. This is just stupid fun. It's, the good guys going after the evil Nazis. And what's great about this movie is, there are lots of explosions, very clear and, clear bad guys and good guys in a snowy mountain retreat that the Nazis have a prisoner in. Burton and Eastwood, it's a young Clint Eastwood, are going out. They're sent on a special mission. And what's interesting is in the middle of the mission, there is a twist. Much like Barry talked about in his favorite movie, there's a twist and a turn that someone makes in this movie that makes the ending really compelling. And it's a really kind of comes out of nowhere ending that makes it like at least a full point better. And, Barry, one of the things I love a good obscure reference. And I remember a couple years ago looking on John McAdams' Pro Wrestling and Whatever Facebook page. And there is a person that posts on John McAdams' page called Cartwright Jones. And what's great about that name is Cartwright Jones is the name of one of the minor characters in Where Eagles Dare. And I popped for that. And I actually inboxed the guy and I said, I love an obscure movie reference like that. And for this guy on John McAdams' Facebook page to have one of the minor characters from Where Eagles Dare as his Facebook name in this page just absolutely cracks me up. This is a great movie, Barry.
Yeah, it's a great movie too. Cartwright. So I've seen that and I never put two and two together because I've seen his name in that group for several years. I never realized that too. So Richard Burton's another one. We never discuss Richard Burton and I'm not sure why. And I guess it's just the types of movies that we've been talking about. There's another guy that was a movie star. This was an actor that when he acted, he owned the screen, much like James Cagney.
And he was in Cleopatra that you referenced earlier.
Yeah, well, that's you go back to the relationship between Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, which was crazy. And I believe Burton too. I remember when Richard Burton died, which would have been 1984, and I was working in a restaurant in New York. I guess we don't have time for this now, but just a fantastic actor. This is a great movie, and what's kind of cool about this too is that I know that some of these movies that we've mentioned that people have never seen, they're actually seeking out. But I'm going to do the same, Jeff, because a couple of the movies that you mentioned that I have never seen, I will seek out. I'll look, whether it's on Netflix or Amazon Prime, to check them out.
Yeah. Lots of explosions, good World War II drama. So Where Eagles Dare, terrific movie, Barry. So, Barry, anything before we go here as we're wrapping it up for this week?
No, just, you got a couple of big events coming up. Obviously, have your daughter's wedding coming up in a couple of weeks. And I'm super excited because, if I go to a wedding and I don't get drunk and get naked on the dance floor, it's not really a wedding. So I'm real excited about that.
Yes, sir, and Mrs. Baldwin, certainly looking forward to that event.
Oh, everybody in attendance, I'm sure, looking forward to that. And then, of course, CWF Legends Fan Fest taking place the direct week after that. And then after that, Jeff, I think I'm going to stay home and rest for a week. So real excited about what the future holds.
Absolutely. I would encourage all of you to follow me on Twitter at Baldwin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe is available through the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Barry, I just want to say one last thing. I noticed on our Facebook group, Breaking Kayfabe with Baldwin and Barry, we are close to that magic 1,000 members. So we encourage you to mention us to your friends if you haven't already, and let's expand the group. We have lots of fun on that Facebook page, and we want to encourage you all to be interactive. We enjoy having fun talking with everybody. And until next week, for Barry Rose from Bixby, Oklahoma, chewing on that cosmic cookie, we'll talk to you next week, folks.